Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend. Winning is an everyday mindset, and we're here to help. I'm Craig Robinson. Join me and Coach John Calipari for Ways to Win. We're kicking off during March Madness. Cal's Kentucky Wildcats are in the hunt, so throughout the tournament, I'm going to call up my friend to ask about his wins, losses, and especially what he's telling his players in the locker room.
You got to win every day.
Find the Ways to Win podcast anywhere you listen.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
We made USAA insurance to help you save. Take advantage of discounts when you cover your home and your ride. Discover how we're helping members save at USAA.com/bundle. USAA. Restrictions apply.
Right now at Safeway, earn 4x rewards points when you shop for participating items with Safeway for you. Shop for items like Ready Whip whipped cream, Deer Park natural spring water, Dan and Danimals drinks, Philadelphia cream cheese, and 7-Up. To earn 4x rewards points with Safeway for you. Offer expires January 4th. Plus, get select holiday essentials like gift wraps, bags, holiday decor, lights, and more. Buy one, get one 50% off. Restrictions apply. Promotions may vary. Visit Safeway.com or head in store for full offer details.
Just listen to punk rock really allowed you to think, oh, I could do this. You know, I could write a Daft Love song. The impetus to write lyrics was just turning on the John Peel show and hearing bands sing about things that you wouldn't expect rock bands to sing about. You know, I would come home from school really upset because somebody in my band had shown a lack of commitment. And my mum would talk me through it, you know, the sort of pains of artistic collaboration and all that sort of stuff. The bus driver said, what are you doing? I said, I'm just going to town. He went, get you. I said, what do you mean? What do you mean? He went, you don't talk to the pops. I say, you're not getting the bus. And he wouldn't let me on the bus.
You're listening to Pop, The History Makers, with me, Steve Blame.
First of all, I just want to tell you that I'm 44% English.
44% English.
24% Irish. 18% Spanish. 6% Swedish. I reckon that's Viking. And I found out this week that I'm 6% Ashkenazi Jew, which who originated in the Rhineland, which is where I live in Cologne. And I now have a German passport. So I just want to get this English-Scottish thing out of the way immediately.
Did you do one of those DNA ancestry things then?
Yeah, I did. You should do one. I highly recommend it because
Ashkenazi Jews seem to come up a lot.
Yeah, well, basically, what the history of the Ashkenazi Jew, which I only know from this week, is that in the Middle Ages they were here, they were pushed out, from Cologne to the east. And really were then in Eastern Europe, all a great swathe of Eastern Europe. So were travellers or Romani, you could call them.
We
knew that my father's father was a Romani. So that must have been the origination. And of course, they were decimated during the Second World War in the camps. And So most of my relations are actually in America, and I know none of them. Anyhow, that's right. My DNA. I want to get out of that. I want to go into your history a little bit. Do you come from a musical family? Because I know your father was a choir master for the Scottish National Orchestra. So how much music was there around you when you grew up? And what sort of influence did that have on you?
Well, I was thinking about this recently, because if you'd asked me this when I was in my 20s, I would have said there wasn't much music. I mean, there wasn't a piano. There was a harpsichord sitting in the hall that we used to play every now and then. But there wasn't any communal music. There wasn't much singing along or stuff like that. I mean, it was my dad's job. So he had a study, and he would be locked in that study, generally not making a noise, just working on scores and things. And also, my dad's job seemed to involve more admin than music. So he always had an office in the house and with lots of office equipment. And he had a secretary, and you never heard any music coming out of the office. You were more likely to hear music coming out of the living room with my mum playing a bit of light jazz or opera or something. So I never really, compared to other families, I never thought that we were particularly musical. But now looking back, we were taken to see classical concerts and operas and things when we were kids, which we hated, you know, because they were terribly boring. But we were exposed to a lot of culture, you know, a lot of, our mum was an actor. So by the time she had kids, she'd given up her career, but she still did quite a lot of university acting and things. So we used to go and see her in plays quite a lot. So we were exposed to lots of stuff, but none of it ever felt particularly familial. If you compared me and my sister's upbringing to other people we knew, I mean, they were having, they were getting the guitars out after dinner, and they would have parties, and people would, their neighbours and friends, parents' friends would come around and sing pop songs and things. We didn't have any of that.
Yeah, although what you say, I mean, okay, there's one side, which is this getting the guitars out, and that's other families and so on, and that's very then, you know, a musical family. But certainly there was, I would imagine, there's an air of cultural support there. Whereas if you look at most families, and I don't know, I mean, my family's not average either, but my father was a market trader, my mother was a housewife, the music that we heard would be something like Glenn Miller or something like that, that would be my mother's taste. And there wasn't an atmosphere of, there is an aspect, a cultural aspect, which is an area that you could get into within your life. Did you feel that you always had some sort of support to do something culturally in your life?
Yeah, we definitely had that. So, and I was the only one of the three of us that seemed to show that bent. And that, you know, I formed a band when I was at school, you know, and I went to a lot of gigs when I was quite young. So yes, I was definitely encouraged, especially by Barbara, our mother. Our dad wasn't around much. He was away a lot, working. But yes, there was certainly no discouragement from our father, and I got lots of encouragement from my mum. I used to discuss, I would come home from school really upset because somebody in my band had shown a lack of commitment, and my mum would talk me through it, you know, the sort of pains of artistic collaboration and all that sort of stuff.
How old were you?
So yeah, what was that?
How old were you?
This is probably when I was 14 or something like that, 13 or 14, I would say. Yeah, probably. The band probably got together when I was 14.
So you were taking it pretty seriously early on, really. If you were having a discussion with your mother.
I was a very serious young man. Really, really serious. I mean, I as soon as punk rock sort of showed me the way, in that you didn't have to be a virtuoso of anything, you could just grab an instrument and start expressing yourself. And if you had any kind of originality, then you could probably get a gig. And if you had any sort of drive, you could probably get a gig. So as soon as I found that way of doing things, I was completely completely obsessed by it, you know.
What was the thrill? When was your first gig, and what was the thrill of doing that? Even if it was a school gig or whatever it was, what did it mean to you actually to be on stage and to be the focus of attention and to be able to play the music that you wanted to play?
Well, the first gig we did was organised by our drummer Paul Tiagi, and we only found out a few days before that. In fact, we just thought it was a sort of local disco at his town hall. He lived in a place called Bears Den, which is a kind of suburb on the edge of Glasgow. And anyway, he booked this gig, a headline gig at the Bears Den Borough Hall, which is quite a big venue, but probably holds about 800 people or something. But then he informed us a few days before that it was actually a benefit for the local Liberal Party, which is like, it couldn't be less cool if he tried. I suppose it could have been the Conservative Party. It could have been slightly worse. Which I was absolutely furious about, but by that point it was too late. But it turned out to be a really good gig. It was just a bunch of, sort of 15-year-olds and maybe some 20-somethings, and we must have been absolutely horrendous. But I remember loving it because the room was full, and I suppose because it was a political benefit, they just kind of nodded their heads and patronised us. So it was quite a forgiving baptism.
What was it like musically?
Oh, we'd have done one cover. We'd have done Tired of Waiting by the Kinks. I think that was the first cover we did. But the rest of it was just all very monotonous little guitar riffs and some very odd lyrics thrown over the top. You wouldn't say it was even melodic. It would have just, not atonal, but not melodic either. I tend to just, me and the other guitar player that wrote the lyrics, we tended just to sing one note through everything, and the guitars didn't do much different either. God knows what it sounded like. I mean, we went from that to becoming postcard copyists very quickly. We got really obsessed by Orange Juice and Joseph K, and we actually discovered some footage of a very, very early Delamitri from when we were, you know, like 15, 16. And it's horrendous because we're just aping the wee sort of moves of Orange Juice and Joseph K. It's incredibly embarrassing. You know, they were obviously, we're desperate in love with these men that are 5 or 6 years older than us, and we kind of worship them, and we're just completely copying them.
What about your love of words? Because you're, you know, one of the things that has really been an identification factor of your music is your lyrics. And I just wondered whether at school there were particular books you read or particular things that you liked, which have always stayed with you, and you love the phrasing of in these books, or you love something about them, or this is something that came up later.
Yeah, the lyrics, there might have been books. I mean, I did read books. And it was English and art were the only subjects I could cope with at school that I didn't find incredibly difficult. I mean, I read Sylvia Plath quite early, and I think that was probably quite a big influence. But I read Sylvia Plath because we had the books in the house, and Sylvia Plath's quite accessible when you're a teenager because it's incredibly angst-ridden. It really appeals. I mean, obviously things like Catcher in the Rye and me and my sisters read quite a lot of Ted Hughes as well. Those books were hanging around, but mainly the impetus to write lyrics was just turning on the John Peel show and hearing bands sing about things that you wouldn't expect rock bands to sing about. You know, singing about, I don't know, being on the dole, or writing love songs in quirky, new, original ways, writing political songs. You know, the punk and post-punk and new wave, lyrically everything got kind of blown wide open. I mean, prior to that, it was all glam rock and prog rock in my world. And the lyrics in prog rock are just really awful. They're incredibly obscure and very hard to relate to. They tend to mainly involve sort of dragons and pirates and things. So again, just listening to punk rock really allowed you to think, oh, I could do this. You know, I could write a Daft Love song.
I mean, what you mentioned, you know, the first gig and it was a Liberal Party benefit. And also, you've also sort of just mentioned some sort of political awareness that you had at that time, that we're roughly the same age. And the late 70s and early 80s, I saw them as a really shit period. In musical terms, they were fantastic. In political and social terms, there was this massive upheaval. So I was, you know, I was down south. I was in a town called Chelmsford, which is north of London. And I moved to London in my early 20s. And the world seemed horrendous at that time with misogyny, racism, homophobia, you name it. It was all there. What was your world like in those terms? Did you find that you were sort of, that music provided an escape for you even in those early days from the wider world? Or was it a way to see the wider world?
It definitely was a way to see the wider world. The escape narrative isn't true of a band like Delamitri, who are firmly middle class, you know. And I came from an incredibly privileged background in that I had a very, very understanding parents. Went to a very sort of, not a private school, but to all intents and purposes, it may as well have been a private school. I had a private school ethos. I mean, it wasn't fee paying, but it may as well have been. It was a fucking hideous place. But not in any way School of Hard Knocks or rough. So there was no, you know, my life's trajectory was going to be go to university, do an arts degree, and I don't know, fuck knows what the trajectory was after that, but certainly go to university for 3 or 4 years. And what the music thing did was just completely change that direction. And funnily enough, you know, you're talking about this sort of political culture at the time. You've got that kind of really sort of entrenched late 70s unreconstructed sexism and racism, as you're saying. And then you had the Thatcher Revolution, which created a sort of, in my world, created a sort of mild, disdainful form of protest, but not real protest. There wasn't real anger in the way that there was, you know, during the miners' strike or something. The Thatcher Revolution, we sort of sneered at it. We did absolutely fuck all about it. But because of the Thatcher's sort of drive to make everybody an entrepreneur, there were schemes available that meant you could leave school and sign on to a yacht scheme or something and get a bit of money every week that would pay for rehearsal. So ironically, and I know Alan McGee from Creation said this, ironically, the early period of the Thatcher government was really beneficial to people like us that wanted to go arty and wanted to go and just sign on and not be hassled into some shitty job and just rehearse as much as we could. And effectively, that was the kind of making of us, in that, you know, we could sign on and rehearse cheaply and rehearse like 6 days a week, you know, and that was really where we learned our stuff after I'd left school and once I was kind of out in the world.
There seems to be quite a long period until the first album was released, and that you were together as a band. So there's, you know, there's this long lead up to it. In that period, and I presume you were listening to lots of indie bands in that period, and following those. Who did you want to be musically at that point as a band?
Well, we started off, once Ian joined the band in 82, prior to that, we just wanted to be Orange Juice and Joseph Kay. That was it. And then once Ian joined, we tried to be a cross between Television and Captain Beefheart. We didn't sound like that at all, but that's what we were aiming for in terms of the guitar arrangements. We didn't want any chords. We wanted all the guitars to be single lines or maybe arpeggiated lines. and wanted to sort of fit those together with very melodic bass and quite strange drums. We were really obsessed with the first Feelies album as well. That was a big influence. Though they did use a lot of chords, unlike Captain Beefheart. But yeah, we were obsessed by Beefheart, the Feelies television, and obsessed with writing songs in a collective way, writing songs with all four members contributing.
Was that difficult then? Was that difficult to do that?
Yeah, that was really. It was really hard. I mean, as I say, that's why we were rehearsing 5 or 6 days a week. And we rehearsed like 7-8 hours a day. It was nuts. And I mean, I suppose I was kind of the ringmaster in that we would come in and I would just point at one of the guitar players and say, just play something, you know, every day. So there was a lot of kind of jamming around little loops of guitar figures. And then we would try and mash things together. And that doesn't work. That's the wrong key. Oh, that doesn't work, it's the wrong tempo. And eventually we'd find all these bits that we'd worked on and come up with parts for based on something that one of the guitar players had played. We would sort of fit those together, make some kind of structure that I would record on cassette, and then I would take that home and write a bunch of words over the top and then come back in and maybe dick around a bit with the structure, but not much. But that literally took 2 or 3 months per song, you know. It was an incredibly labour-intensive way of doing things. I mean, the end result was we got the first album. I listen to it now, and in spite of lots of things that are very embarrassing about it, musically it's very dense and complicated, and I think it's quite original, you know, in its own way, because it's not. It really is constructed in quite an arty way. It's kind of a patchwork thing. And eventually that became so painful and time-consuming that Ian suggested that we tried writing in a different way, and he just said, look, why don't we just write things separately? And that ended up being a big change in what we did. You know.
What was your expectation of that album? That was on Chrysalis, I think, wasn't it, the first album?
Yeah.
So when you got that signed, there must have been a sort of particular expectation about how this is going to go. What was your expectation, and how did that pan out?
Well, we had very low expectations commercially because we were signed to an indie offshoot of Chrysalis called Big Star. You know, one of these pseudo indie labels that all the major labels launched in the early 80s. So we weren't given a huge amount of money. We were given 25,000 quid, which was enough to put us on wages, you know, allowed us to go full time, allowed us to buy a bit of gear. And it would, you know, that money probably lasted just like a year and a half or something. But there was no commercial pressure from Chrysalis because we were on this indie label. I guess the expectation from the label was, oh, maybe they'll get into the indie chart and one of the singles will be in the top 10 of the indie singles chart or something, or maybe they'll get a good review. But this rather odd thing happened after we signed to Chrysalis. We were just getting on with making the first album. We were quite well thought of in the weekly music press, you know, the Enemy, Melody Maker and Sounds covered us favourably because we were part of that postcard scene, you know. And we were getting better. We were starting to do some quite interesting things, I think. But then what happened was our manager managed to get the attention of the editor of Melody Maker, a guy called Ian Pye, to get interested in what we were doing at Chrysalis. So she sent him the first three songs that we'd recorded. They were unmixed, as I remember, that we'd recorded for the first album. So she sent Ian Pye these songs and he went apeshit about them. And then, kind of off his own back, put us on the cover of Melody Maker before we released anything. We'd released one indie single like a year and a half before or something, or a year before. So all of a sudden we were being touted by the Melody Maker as the future of, you know, of British indie pop. So then what happened was that the A&R department at Chrysalis phoned up the press department and said, who's this band, Delamitri? We should sign them. And the press department said, you signed them 6 months ago. So then what happened was the A&R department started putting us under pressure, because prior to that, we were just on this little indie offshoot of Christmas and nobody knew what the hell we were up to because we weren't spending very much money. So we were flying under the radar. But as soon as this Melody Maker cover happened, the record company got extremely nervous and thought, oh, we've got this precious hip property that they didn't know what to deal with. So then they hummed and hawed about putting the first single out. And then they decided that we should wait until we'd finished the album. Anyway, so we ended up not releasing anything for like 6 months or something, by which time there'd been a huge backlash because the other music papers, who to a certain extent were more influential, actually, Sounds and the NME, thought, well, who the fuck are these guys? You know, they put one single, the Melody Maker put them in the cover with a centre spread article, and then they never put anything out. This is just fucking hype. So by the time the album came out, we were absolutely savaged by the Sounds and the NME. So that was game over, because we were, as you know, you were asking about expectations. There were no commercial expectations for that record. It just had to get good reviews, and then we would have done another record, and then maybe we could have built an audience, and you know, we played some universities, and we could have maybe got slightly bigger or reached a slightly wider audience, but without any hullabaloo or commercial pressure. So yes, it was fucked. It was totally fucked. It fucked by the fact that our record company just made a complete arse of it, you know. But I mean, Chrysalis were just one of they were, even though they were a small major, they were just hideous in the 80s. They were the Spandau Ballet record label. There was a lot of cocaine going on. There was a lot of, you know, A&R guys getting on planes to Glasgow with, you know, somebody in the office they were having an affair with and spending shitloads of money to sign, you know, ostensibly hip bands from the town that produced Postcard. And it was a really horrible culture. It was the antithesis of everything we were about. You know, it was kind of glam and hedonistic and, you know, it just wasn't for us at all. We were these little middle-class socialists who were trying to do something, you know, original and deeply indie. And it was the wrong label for that.
And when they finally decided to pull the plug on the contract, you were in America, yeah, weren't you? How did that feel at that time?
No, we weren't in America. We were, we actually tried to get them to drop us because they took up the option on the second album, to our great surprise, because obviously the whole thing had been a huge commercial and critical failure, or not even a huge failure, just a failure. But then for some weird reason, they took up the second option. I think because it was cheap to do, they only had to pay us a small amount of money to keep us on the label. And then we realized that they were going to sit on us and force us to write pop songs, which we couldn't do and weren't willing to do. And we realized that we were going to get into one of these awful traps that happens to an awful lot of bands where they're still signed to the label, but the label won't let them record because they're not writing sufficiently commercial material. So the label won't spend any money in the recording studio on the artist, which should be illegal, but to this day, it's not illegal. So we, our manager and us, sort of stays a kind of sit-in in the offices, and we print up these T-shirts saying "Release the Dells" to try and force them to drop us because we couldn't work. You know, we couldn't. They wouldn't give us any money to do anything because they considered what we were doing uncommercial. So then we tried to compromise, and we wrote a sort of pop song called "Tears and Trickery," and then they said, "Oh, that's quite good. Write us another three of those." And we said, "No, we're not doing that. Fuck off." So yes, we got into this big sort of battle with Chrysalis. And then eventually they dropped us, I think maybe spring 86. So it was actually after that we went to America with our sort of last couple of thousand quid, which we spent on airfares. So yeah, that was how that happened.
What was the plan with going to America then? If you were at that point, you know, you're at that point, you haven't got a label, you've got yourself out in some way, and you're going off to America with limited money.
Well, we had no money. We had no money. We had £2,000 in the bank, which we spent on airfares. It was a big plan by Barbara Shores, our manager, who's an American woman who'd moved to the UK to make a postcard fanzine. She was obsessed with postcards, as a lot of Californians were in the early 80s. But she always had this dream of taking like a Scottish band to America and showing them America, which is what she did. So the plan was spend the last money we had on airfares, do a private party in New Jersey that was being put on by a big fan called Tim Haaland, I think. And that was going to raise a couple of $1,000s, which would allow us to buy a van. And then we were going to go around staying in fans, in most cases, parents' houses, where they would put gigs on for us, either in their aunt's house or in a record shop or in a local club that they'd hired. Because in the intervening years, we'd been writing to all these fans and kind of grooming them to help us. Could you put a gig on for us? Oh yeah, I'm having a 21st birthday party. Yeah, I'll rent a club in Orlando and we'll sell tickets and we'll give you the money. So that's how that worked. And it was budgeted, and it sort of depended on selling quite a lot of badges and t-shirts, and busking was quite a big part of it. So what happened when we got to the States was the guy who was having the private party, who said he was going to sell 200 tickets at $20 a head, he effectively had a nervous breakdown, partly because there was 10 of us sleeping on his living room floor in a small apartment in Jersey Heights. That didn't help. But he hadn't sold the tickets that he claimed that he'd sold. So he didn't have any money for us. He just had a couple hundred bucks. So then we had to start phoning other fans that we'd been in touch with, saying, could they lend us stuff? Because we were going to hire equipment. We had to borrow all the equipment before we went on the road. We borrowed a van from a commercial van hire place that was run by a Mancunian guy again in New Jersey. It was just insane. The whole thing was absolutely insane.
But how formative was that musically? And also, as people, because, you know, when you travel to another country and when you get that sort of experience, you do change. It changes you, especially at a young age. And also, you had this musical experience, and you're then presumably more open to what's culturally going on in another country. So I just wondered how that changed you in both those areas.
It was completely formative. It was our backpacking year out, you know. It was formative in the sense that it was extremely stressful psychologically because we were hungry all the time. We weren't getting enough sleep because we were just pulling over and sleeping in picnic rest areas because we didn't have money for any accommodation at all. We would get fed and watered when we were in a town where a fan was putting on a gig for us. So, you know, their parents would open the very generously and hospitably open the frigidaires to us. So formative in that sense. It was kind of miraculous that we got round the whole circuit. Musically, it was a huge change because American audiences are wildly different from European audiences, and everything is a lot more showbiz. You know, everything's about performance and sort of showing off. And we learned really quickly to respond to that because American audiences teach you that. You know, they're extremely vocal. They'll tell you what bits they like, and then you just play up to that, and it becomes quite histrionic, you know. But that's fun. That's really great fun. So it changes in that 6-week tour. We went from being a very earnest, slightly shoegazy indie postcard band to being a rock band, you know, with guitar solos. I mean, we didn't realize that we had guitar solos until these guys would go, "Ooh," and start clapping. Oh, that's a guitar solo. We just thought that was a bit, you know. Also the other thing that was musically formative was we went into a lot of college radio stations because quite a few college radio stations played the first Telemetry record. And we would talk to these guys and go, "What else are you listening to?" And, you know, they would play you some really interesting American indie music, but they were also listening to like deeply mainstream white Midwestern shit, you know. And they didn't really see any difference between, Bob Seger and REM. There was rock. It was alternative rock to them, you know, or it was just rock. And that was, that just blew all the kind of punk rock puritanism away. It just blew it away because it didn't matter anymore. You could, if these guys thought we were the same as Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers, then we were. We were the same genre. It was just rock music. So that it just meant we could take the straitjacket of taste and, the straitjacket of taste just went. And it meant that we could write things in any mode we like. We could write things in a blues mode. We could write things in a country mode. And also, actually, prior to going to America, we started listening to quite a lot of country music. And that was quite a big change as well. But yes, the American trip changed us as people and as musicians. And it completely changed our opinion of Americans, whom we snootily thought were just all big fat idiots that, you know, like Ronald Reagan before we went over there. And then we lived and effectively worked with these people for days at a time and were overwhelmed by their generosity, their intelligence, their, you know, their cultural acumen. They were just, all these people were just fascinating, you know, interesting, really deeply decent people. So yes, America became unlike other bands' experience of America, which you see it off a tour bus, and you can end up being extremely cynical about America in that environment. We'd been living with people's parents and with our extended families and sleeping in their bedrooms and swimming in their pools or you know, sitting in their yards drinking.
Now, don't worry, I'm not going to stop the interview. I just want to ask you to subscribe because it helps me and it allows you to know about the interviews when they're uploaded on the YouTube channel. Okay, back to the interview.
We went to the States to achieve two things, to get round it in one piece and to come back with an indie record deal. And we'd set our sights on a label called Big Time in Los Angeles, which is an indie record company. So we spoke to them when we were out there, and when we came back, they sent us a bit of money to do some demos. So we did a bunch of demos that I guess would have been probably.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
I suppose would constitute the sort of second Delamitri indie album. And we felt that if we could get through that experience, we could do anything. We really felt we could do anything because, I suppose like the Beatles coming back from Hamburg, if, you know, they must have thought, if we can play like 12 hours a day, we can fucking do anything. If we can get these drunken sailors dancing, you know, or stop them fighting, and if we can just improvise, you know, daft bits of comedy, then, you know, we can, if we can get through that, we can get through anything. And, you know, sleeping on the fucking roadside and running away from electric storms and having band meetings at the Grand Canyon and being genuinely hungry for months at a time, you just think, fuck me, we did that, you know. And it made us feel like we were better than anybody else, you know, because nobody else had, as far as we knew, no other bands in our milieu had done anything like this. Actually, going to the States with no money and just and kind of busking it, you know.
It's an incredibly brave thing to do. I think it's amazing.
It was brave. The bravest person was our manager, Barbara, in that she had the chutzpah to put it together and think that it might work. And of course, it didn't work. I mean, it didn't work because we didn't raise the amount of money we thought we were going to raise. But in some ways, it did work because we did all the gigs. We had to beg, you know, we had to beg for money, but we did do the gigs. But then what happened after we got back was we did the big time demos, which were indie. They were probably a bit less indie than the first Christmas album, but not much. But then Ian and I started writing separate things that were very sort of mainstream and Americana. And then we started thinking, shit, these songs are really mainstream. Is there any point in putting mainstream songs out on a small label? So because our music just morphed quite quickly post the American trip into mainstream rock music, we very quickly went from focusing on getting a small deal and doing a small scale thing to thinking we should sign to another major label. You know, we've got the experience. We're writing pop songs, we should go for it. And so that was a complete shift of planning, you know.
I remember being... I remember being on MTV at that time, MTV Europe, which was started in 1987. And I used to interview people and present the news on the channel. And It was the era of 87. And I think you came along in that sort of era with Waking Hours. But your first two singles... And I think I've got this right. Your first two singles didn't chart, did they? So it must have also been a sort of hit at that point. Okay, we've got our direction. We know where we want to go. We've created songs that we really can stand behind now because they're really part of us. And then the first sense is, oh, shit, this doesn't work. So how was that and how did you get through it? Or did that process just happen quickly and in a nice way?
Well, it did happen in a nice way because we got radio play. So Kiss to Sing Goodbye, which came out, I think, in August 89, I think. It got a bit of Radio 1 play, certainly at night, but it got a lot of commercial radio play. So I would sit in my bedroom at night and tune to the stations, and I would hear it a lot. So that was super encouraging. And also it sounded really good in the radio. So that made us think, look, we've done the right thing here. We've made the right sort of record, because every time we heard those, certainly Kiss the Thing Goodbye on the radio, it just leapt out because it wasn't soaked in all that 80s reverb like everything else was at the time. So we thought we might have a bit of a chance here. So we weren't distressed that the first two singles didn't get into the top 40. I mean, I think they did okay. I think they charted outside the top 40 fairly respectably. And we were also pretty convinced that A&M were going to keep going because we had a two album firm deal, which is quite unusual in those days. So we knew we were going to get a second album. So we weren't panicking about these mainstream things not being hits. And the audience was growing a bit because we had this radio play on local radio stations. So if we did a university gig, less people would drift away. They would, more of them would stick around to watch us. So it felt like we were going in the right direction. But, you know, as you're, you know, sort of hinting, the absolute key in those days was you had to get into the top 40, because if you got into the top 40, you'd be on the television, you might get Top of the Pops, and then overnight you were a six. The absolute key in those days was you had to get into the top 40, because if you got into the top 40, you'd be on the television, you might get Top of the Pops, and then overnight you were a successful group, you know, It was that simple. That was the equation. To get Top 40, get Top of the Pops, you're famous.
Yeah, I mean, it was the equation. I know it's not the equation for a band, because the equation is am I doing what I want to do in life? Am I creating something for me that's worthwhile and that the audience like? But it's very interesting as well, I think, because it is something that you need from an audience, that sort of feedback, and that is in a massive way if you get that success.
Yeah, but our thing was, because we'd been an arty indie band and then suddenly we'd started writing mainstream songs, we were very... We had commercial ambition for the songs because we loved the songs and we loved Waking Hours, but we didn't think it we could justify it unless it was in the charts. So it does. I mean, not because we wanted to be successful, but because the charts are where that shit belonged. You know the first Elementary album didn't belong in the charts. It belonged in, you know, indie clubs and in polytechnics. You know, that's where that music sat. But because we'd written these fucking mainstream, slightly Americana things, they didn't make any sense outside of the mainstream. So we were really keen to have a hit, really keen to have a hit. I mean, again, not for commercial reasons so much as the sort of creative sense that that's where that stuff belongs. You know, it belongs... You know, we want housewives who listen to Radio 2 to hear this stuff. We didn't want them to hear the old stuff because they wouldn't have understood it, you know. Forgive the term housewife, but that was the thinking at the time, you know.
I am a housewife.
Well, so am I.
You've just described me because I was listening to it. Thank you. It's made me very happy. In terms of success, though, When Nothing Ever Happens came out, and it was massive, and MTV played it to death at that time. Right. And I just wonder whether it changed your mentality in any way to have that success and to suddenly be recognisable and to have that confirmation in some way.
Yeah. The validation was good because, you know, the incredible snobbery of the sort of hipper parts of the Glasgow music scene had always thumbed their nose at Delamitri, which we took some pride in, but we took a hell of a lot more pride in beating them at their own game, which was, you know, being in the charts. So that was very revenge is sweet. Revenge really is sweet, and I don't let anybody tell you different. But other than that, I might be wrong. I don't think it had that much effect because we were so long in the tooth by that point. I mean, you know, I'd been in a band called Delamitri since 1980, so it'd been at least 10 years of a young person's life that I'd been doing this, and then people were recognising me in the street. So I think we found it was a bit odd, but we found it very amusing, partly because it immediately made our lives easier. You know, we were playing nicer venues, we had nicer dressing rooms, we had a nicer van. What's not to love about that, you know? Things are actually improving just in terms of the quality of our lives. The sort of fame aspect we dealt with immediately by nipping it in the buds. We didn't play up to it. We didn't glam up. We didn't start buying expensive clothes. We didn't change. We didn't move out of our flats in the middle of Glasgow. We didn't stop going to the pubs that we went to. We were just there, you know. So that the slight weirdness of being known dissipated very quickly because we just didn't react to it. We just kind of ignored it. And Glasgow's quite a good place to be on the telly last night because people will they'll be quite blunt with you, you know. I tried to, the day after we were on Top of the Pops the first time, I tried to get on a bus just around the corner from my flat to go into town. And the bus driver said, "What are you doing?" I said, "I'm just going to town." He went, "Get you fucking." I said, "What do you mean? What do you mean?" He went, "You don't talk to the Pops. I say, you're not getting the fucking bus." And he wouldn't let me on the bus. So, I mean, I know that it's a bit of a cliche that, you know, Cleveland and Glasgow and these post-industrial towns are quite sort of frank, or the people are quite frank and bold with their... The way they react to people that they perceive that might be sort of elevating themselves. I think there is some truth in it. So we, you know, I think if we'd lived in London, it'd be a lot weirder. And I think we'd have ended up going up our own fundament if we'd lived in London. But living in Glasgow, it was partly people were really pleased for you and really proud of you. And also partly they would just take the absolute piss out of you. So none of that felt too mad. And also we felt like we deserved it. We felt like we'd worked really hard. We made a really good first record, which got savaged by the critics because of a mistake with the record company. We'd made a really good second record, which is very different from the first. And we thought, it felt totally deserved to be, you know, flying around Europe doing a promo tour and eating in nice restaurants or whatever the glamorous side of that is. I don't know.
Well, one of the things that I think really speaks for the quality of the band is that you continued on that level of success till about 2002 as a band. And that's a long period. I mean, if you look at pop bands, I mean, we did research at MTV in the late 80s about the length of a pop band or the length of a pop star, their main part of the career. It's about 4 years. And there, you know, you went on for like 12, 14 years of success.
I mean, the success dipped, but by 97, the success dipped, but we were on Radio 1 over those three albums consistently with every single, you know, with like all four singles from each album. Radio 1 played us to death. And commercial radio, the big commercial radio station played us to death. Why that is, I don't know. I think there was a lot of luck involved. The record company was certainly a lot to do with that. They had a brilliant promotions department. They were very supportive of the record company. They let you do things in your own way. They didn't try and force you to do things that you were uncomfortable with. And because we'd never been part of, apart from the early Postcard years, we weren't part of the Postcard scene anyway, because we'd never been part of a scene or a movement or a thing, we just slipped between the cracks at radio, and radio loved us because we were sort of rock, we were sort of pop. We weren't sort of pre-Britpop, we weren't indie dance, we weren't anything trendy. So that, I think a lot of radio producers just thought, well, that's just reliable. You know, we can play that and it's not going to frighten the horses and it works. And we did make radio-friendly records, you know. We thought about it. We were very concerned with how they were mixed, and I mean, especially by the time we got to Twisted. And we were really concerned with being a pop rock band. We wanted to be a rock band live but have radio hits, you know. And we got away with it for quite a while, you know, which was quite remarkable. Without any great pressure, there was no pressure from like the tabloid press, there was no huge pressure from the record company to move up another gear, to be playing stadiums, you know. We just carried on in this middle ground of the mainstream, which was an extremely comfortable place to be.
Was waning success a reason that in 2002 that you went your separate ways for a while?
Yeah.
And so that was a very comfortable decision between you. That wasn't something that everyone was like, oh, no, I want to carry on. And you were saying, no, I'm going to go. It was something that was a mutual agreement.
Well, that decision was made between Ian and me and our manager, John. So we got dropped by A&M that had become, wasn't A&M then, it was Mercury at that point. It had been bought over so many times. It wasn't the label that it had been. So we got dropped by Mercury, which we were more than happy about. And we sort of took stock for a couple of months. And my assumption was that we would just sign to a sort of Beggar's Banquet type label and make albums on smaller budgets and play to smaller crowds and keep going for another 10 years or something. That was my assumption. But then we had a meeting and Ian and John said, I mean, that could be quite depressing. And I thought about it and I thought about some of the kind of half-empty halls that we played on the last tour in 2002 in the UK. And I thought, yeah, that could be quite depressing. and also in those days, this was before the days when you could make money on the road. It was before ticket prices went through the fucking roof. So that didn't look particularly appealing. So we just stopped. We just we'd done Delamitri. Nobody wanted it. The audience didn't want any more. You know, they had nobody had bought the last album. Can You Know Me Good? There was only one single from that, which didn't get played in the radio. It was definitely over. You know, definitely over.
I mean, you said you'd done Delamitri. You went off and you've made four albums in between. And I've got to jump, but you made four albums in between. But then the decision came to reform, as it were,
and to
create another album. Why did that come about, or how did that come about?
Well, it came about because the reason we stopped is that the phone wasn't ringing. There were not queues of promoters wanting us to play in Germany or the United States or the UK or Australia or any of the places that we'd previously been reasonably successful. And we didn't really think the phone would ever ring again. I mean, I suspected that it might because I'd seen a few bands just drop off the radar and then all of a sudden come back into the sort of public consciousness for weird, strange reasons, like a track would crop up in a film or you know, something would get played on a public holiday on the radio and people would go, oh God, that band were quite good. So I had a vague feeling that the phone might start ringing again, but I wasn't terribly sure. So yes, I was just getting on with doing what I was doing and so was Ian. And then our manager called up, in, I suppose, 2013 or something, maybe 2012, and said, oh, you know, your agent thinks that you might be able to play Hammersmith Odeon. And so that was it, really. That was, oh. And I think we just quite liked the idea of playing Hammersmith Odeon and making some money, because by then you could make money on the road, because, as I say, all the money had gone out of CD sales because recorded music was free. And all the money had gone into the live arena because all of a sudden audiences who weren't buying records had spare money to spend on concert tickets. And so people just started going to a lot more gigs and paying a lot more money for the gigs. So that was really interesting. It's like, fuck, we don't have to go make a record and get on this treadmill of promoting album tour and all that sort of stuff. We could just go and do a bunch of gigs for fun, but make a lot of money. What's not to love about that? So that's really what happened, was that the music business had turned on its head in the meantime, and gigs became viable, a viable activity in terms of finance, you know, which they weren't before. They were, you know, everybody's gigs in the 90s were effectively supported by the recorded music industry. You know, they were all underwritten by record companies. So that's why tickets were so cheap.
But that then morphed into this idea of let's do a new album, let's create music again together.
Yeah. We decided on the 2014 tour not to do any new material. And then by the time we got to the 2018 tour, we'd started writing new material for that tour. So it was a sort of natural progression. I was the most resistant. Ashley, our drummer, and Ian were really up for it. They really thought it'd be a great thing to do another record. I canvassed a lot of my mates and said, why would we do this? Because I really hate bands that piss off for 10 years and then come back and make another record and sully their back catalogue. That just drives me nuts. So I was really against it. But all my mates went, oh, it'd be brilliant, it'd be brilliant, it'd be brilliant. I mean, to a person, everybody I spoke to, was really excited about it. So that made me think, well, I better go and write some fucking Delamitri songs then. And then I wrote a bunch of Delamitri songs. And I thought, well, these are quite good. I wouldn't have written these if there hadn't been the possibility of Delamitri making an album. Well, that's quite interesting. And then I started to really enjoy writing for the group again, you know, because previously I'd really enjoyed not writing for the group. I'd really enjoyed just writing anything I cared to write, whereas writing for a group is a much more focused thing, you know, and it's more, you're more limited in your scope of what you can write for a band, I think, and that's a good thing because it forces you to think in different ways.
One thing that I think Well, I'm going to say that maybe there's something in common, because I'm a screenwriter. And what I do when I write screenplay is I create a world, and that world is then I put a story within that world around the theme that I want to explore. Mm-hmm. And I always think that is something similar to creating music, because you're creating, I don't know which comes first, but you're creating the music and the sort of lyrics go in. And what you do with the lyrics is somehow they sometimes go against what the music stands for. The music is, you know, it's positive and it gives you a good feeling. And the lyrics are sometimes really unexpected, you know, and I wouldn't say negative, but they've got this sort of touch to them, which is really, oh, wow, I wasn't expecting that. So how do you go about creating a song, and what do you want to achieve by it? Because that dynamic is really Delamitri dynamic within a song.
I'm not conscious of that too much, and I wouldn't want to be, you know, as a writer yourself, you know that self-consciousness is the enemy of all creativity. So that's not something that I consciously think about. But if I'm co-writing with Ian, the music will tell me what the lyric is. So as you're saying, even though a lot of the songs that bands like us write, the music's quite positive, and sometimes the lyrics can be quite, it's hard to find an adjective that isn't the word dark, which is such a sort of meaningless cliche, but yes, the lyrics can be more negative, and that can work quite nicely. But I think I'm pretty sure I get the sourness from the music, you know. And then the other thing is, it's much easier to create drama if there's things going wrong in a song than if things are going right. So I was thinking about this the other day, actually, because I remembered that in the mid-90s, I wrote two absolutely positive love songs, you know, just really, there's not a hint of cynicism or poison or resentment in them at all, which is completely unusual for me. And I was thinking about those songs and going, oh yeah, they're quite good songs, those, you know. And then I was thinking, wonder why I didn't write more of those. And it's because I think it's because those sorts of songs, you start repeating yourself really quickly. The kind of imagery that you can reach for to describe contentment and love and gaiety is much more limited than the kind of language that you can use to describe resentment, jealousy, pain, suffering, all these things. There's a lot more in there, you know, just to get your teeth around.
And also we connect to them more, don't we? Because we've all experienced those aspects of relationships. Yeah. It's not all light and fun and, you know, I love you, let's get married, it's over.
But frustratingly, people do connect with really up, happy things as well. And I really wish we could do that, because when we do gigs, and I was thinking about David Bowie's Let's Dance the other day. I mean, you know, you hear that song and it makes you feel pretty good, you know.
But he hated it, didn't he? He didn't like it. It was his most unfavourite album. It's what he said.
Yeah, and it's super commercial. And I mean, it probably is kind of horrible. But what most of us want is Let's Dance rather than Masters of War. I mean, that's what we want, because there's more of a sort of communal cathartic experience to be had from, you know, dancing along to something blandly positive than there is to stroking your chin and scratching your nose to something, you know, a deep and profound Leonard Cohen song, you know. I mean, maybe they're more private experiences, but I do find that endlessly frustrating that we don't have more like positive anthems where people can just throw caution to the wind and dance and have a good time. That's, I mean, when we did some acoustic gigs at Edinburgh during the festival this year, and halfway through the gigs, somebody shouted, "Have you not got any happy ones?" And you know, it raised a big laugh, And the answer is like, no. And that's, I think that's not good. I think that has to change.
Well, I'm gonna go back to the beginning just to end. And, you know, I told you my DNA test. I'm sure if you had one, you know, it's going to be pretty way up there, Scottish. And anyone who's who's written Don't Come Home Too Soon for the Scottish football team. And what's the latest one? Close Your Eyes and Think of England, which I absolutely loved. Well, just quickly at the end, what does it mean being Scottish? And for you, what does it mean then being English?
Yeah, well, I mean, I always describe myself as half English because I grew up in England between the ages of 5 and 10, and which were quite formative years for me. You know, it's when I started playing football and listening to music and things. So I've always, because of that, I've always really despised any streak of anti-Englishness that you do find in Scotland. I mean, it doesn't, you don't come across it often, but you do find it lurking sometimes. And sometimes you find it lurking amongst the most urbane, civilized people who have very you have a very bitter opinion of all English people, you know, which is just fucking insane. So I always had this kind of dual nationality thing going on. And when I moved back to Glasgow in the mid-70s, I didn't feel like I fitted in at all, you know. I had to change my accent back from, because I had a Midlands accent when I was a kid. So I had to sort of change that back to a Glasgow accent in order not to get the shit kicked out of me. Because I went to quite a tough primary school when I came back. And I didn't think Glasgow belonged to me, in the words of the Immortal song, until we did Barlands in 1990. So all that time, I felt like a fish out of water, you know. All that early Daily Mitchell stuff, it was all sung in an English accent. I mean, that's partly because of punk, but also partly because I never felt particularly Scottish. But then some things started changing weirdly in the 90s. I remember noticing this traveling up and down from London to Glasgow a lot. And in fact, maybe more in the zeros. And maybe after Scotland got its parliament or something, Scotland started becoming more Scottish, which I wasn't sure about. I didn't know whether this was a bad thing or a good thing. And I found myself becoming more Scottish and feeling more Scottish when I was in London than I had done previously. And I don't know whether this is just because there's a slow atomization of the United Kingdom going on that we're not very sure why that would be. You know, it would certainly explain Brexit, which I think was effectively just a form of English nationalism. And you've got Scottish nationalism, which on the one hand, it's presented as being a very progressive, progressive social democratic movement. But then on the other hand, Scottish nationalism is deeply a deeply suspect conservative instinct. So, in terms of that kind of identity, I still feel kind of British, even though the British nationalism is like, you know, an even dirtier concept than English nationalism, you know. So, I find all that quite confusing. If you talk to young people, when I say young people, I mean people below the age of 35, they've got quite a positive take on Scottishness. They're not anti-English. They love English culture, but they just fucking hate Westminster, and they see Westminster as the enemy, rightly or wrongly. And they've got this attitude that we need to get out of there. Whereas people of my generation have kind of got an attitude that, I can see why political autonomy is a good thing for a small nation, but at the same time, I can also see why it's a bad thing not being represented in the Palace of Westminster as a polity. And I can see why that could be extremely dangerous. So I'm really confused about all that stuff. But it gives you stuff to write about, I guess, you know.
Yeah, exactly. And I just want to thank you at the end for writing songs that have sort of reflected a lot of the trauma and of my relationships over the years.
Our pleasure.
Because I haven't had the happy one yet, but which is coming. And finally, thank you for calling me a housewife. That's made my day. So, Justin, thanks a lot. Yeah.
Cheers. See you again. You too. Much appreciated.
You're listening to Pop, the History Makers, with me, Steve Blame.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Winning is an everyday mindset, and we're here to help. I'm Craig Robinson. Join me and Coach John Calipari for Ways to Win. We're kicking off during March Madness. Cal's Kentucky Wildcats are in the hunt. So throughout the tournament, I'm going to call up my friend to ask about his wins, losses, and especially what he's telling his players in the locker room.
You got to win every day.
Find the Ways to Win podcast anywhere you listen.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.